Hey, before we get started, I should tell you that this is an audio-only interview because, as you'll hear in my voice during the beginning of this interview, I was having some trouble with the video. It just wasn't coming through. So we gave up on it, we continued the conversation, and that's the way I'm going to present it here. It's an audio-only interview since audio, I think, is what came out well and video. This program is sponsored by WooFoo. You guys probably already know by now that WooFoo is the embeddable form that you need to have on your website right now. Use it as a contact form, embed it on your website for free, get great feedback from your audience that you can actually use. You can also get a survey from them that you can embed on your website and so much more. Go to WooFoo.com and you'll see why I've been using them for years. They even did my wedding RSVP form because they were so beautiful and so easy to use. WooFoo.com. I also am a user of Grasshopper. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. If you go over to grasshopper.com, you'll get a phone number that you can add extensions to that you can check no matter where you are in the world. It will make you look professional. Go to grasshopper.com and you'll see why I love that service, Grasshopper. Finally, this interview is sponsored by Shopify, and you know that Shopify is probably the easiest, quickest way for you to set up a robust store online with all the features that you need. Go to Shopify.com, and within minutes, that idea that's been in your head for a store will be up and running and on the web. Shopify.com. All right, here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. Today I've got with me Fred Wilson. Fred, first of all, before I even give you the introduction, thanks for sticking with us on the video. We're doing a video Skype-based interview, and we've had a little bit of trouble getting started, and I appreciate all the work you put into coming on here.
No problem. Happy to do it.
All right, and if we end up with just an audio interview, I guess we'll just have to go with that. Fred, as most of you know, is the co-founder of Union Square Ventures, the investment firm that backed notable tech companies like Twitter, Zynga, Foursquare, Etsy, and he's got a lot of fans, as I can see here in the audio, in the chat. I invited him to Mixergy to ask about the biography of his business, to learn the investment decision-making process along the way. And Fred, the first thing I'm wondering about is your previous company. Before we get into this company, there's a quote that I read about quote from you about that previous company. You said, yeah, boy, we really screwed up a bunch of things. What did you mean by that? What did you guys screw up?
We really had a good thing going from 96, 97, 98. The company selection was good, and we were making excellent returns. There were a number of very good businesses that came out of that period of investing. In 99 and 2000, I think we, like everybody in the business, got a bit carried away with ourselves and started funding things that were not as logical, businesses, overfunded things, funded things at prices that made no sense. At the same time, you know, our firm had gone from two people to 25 people, and it became a little bit institutionalized. We ended up spending a bunch of time managing the firm as opposed to making investments. And the top and most experienced investors became managers, and the people who were investing the capital were younger and less experienced people. And you know, that whole combination just really didn't work very well. And in 2001, we decided to essentially shut things down and wind things down, which we're still in the process of doing, actually. It takes a long time to wind down a venture portfolio. But that's what I meant by it.
I see. How do you get to that place? I mean, you started out with a plan in mind. It wasn't to get where you ended up. How do you end up there?
Well, in that situation, it was just simply a matter of being too successful too quickly. We made a bunch of investments in 96 and 97 that by 98 and 99, had gone public and or sold, and we were generating a lot of returns for ourselves and our partners. And you know, when that happens, I think you want to start replicating that and doing more. And you get caught up in the idea that, wow, if we could turn 150 million into 750 million, we could turn 1.5 billion into 7.5 billion. But the numbers don't work that way.
I see. Why did you decide to get back in the business with a new company?
Well, I had never really intended to get out of the venture business. I just felt that the structure that we had at the end at Flatiron was not the right structure, and winding it down was easier than trying to turn the whole business upside down and start it over again. And so we, you know, we put that business on into wind down mode. And then a couple years later, I started the Union Square venture business with a new partner, Brad Burnham, and that has worked out well. We didn't fall into some of the same traps with this business that we fell into with the last one.
Well, you say that you never intended to get out. Your partner did. He's now a business coach and a life coach. Why didn't you? Why did you want to stay with it?
Well, Jerry is the kind of person that's very intellectually curious, and by the time that I met him, he was already on his third career and was, you know, 32 or 33. The venture business was his third career, and then he became a consultant, which was his fourth career, and now he's a CEO coach, which is his fifth career. So Jerry's capable of doing many different things, and I always saw myself as a venture capitalist and nothing else. I've never really been interested in doing anything else with my professional career. So I think it's just a situation where he had other things he wanted to do with his life, and I didn't.
What is it about venture capital that drew you in the first place?
I always liked the intersection between finance and technology. So I spent a bunch of time in the technology business early in my career, went to MIT, got out, wrote a bunch of software for a while, and then decided that I wanted to go to business school. And while I was at business school, I got into finance. And I think fundamental skills that you need to be a good engineer are not that different than you need to be a good finance person. It's very math oriented and requires strong quantitative skills. And so I was really attracted to a business that would allow me to continue to be deeply in the technology business, but also do a lot with the finance education and interest that I had.
How did you pick your partner?
Which partner?
How about Brad Burnham?
Brad was somebody that I had known and respected for a long time. I don't really ever want to be partners with somebody who I haven't worked with previously. I just think that the risk is too high of not getting along. And that's a really bad situation to be in, to be partners with somebody that you don't really enjoy working with. So Brad's somebody I had known since the mid-90s. We had done some deals together, and specifically we were working on the Dakota deal as angel investors at the time and really enjoying that company and that project and the board. And Brad and I were really the two leading independent outside board members. And so I felt pretty strongly, as did Brad, that we would be compatible. We both had been in the venture business for over a decade and had been through the ups and downs of it and had similar experiences. And so he seemed like a very good choice, and he has been a very good choice.
I asked Jerry Colonna what it was about you that he wanted to partner up with, and he gave me a story about, he told me how you guys had a meeting once and you had to cancel it because you wanted to spend some time with your daughter, and he said, that's the kind of person that I'd want to be in business with. I like his priorities. Do you have a similar example for or story of what made you think that Brad would make a good partner?
Well, I think Brad and I don't have anything quite as colorful as that story that Jerry told you. But Brad and I were at a similar stage in our lives. He has two kids who are in middle school. I've got a son in middle school and a daughter in high school and a daughter in college. He lives in Manhattan. I live in Manhattan. I know his wife very well. He knows my wife very well. I thought that we were, at a very similar point in our careers and in our lives, and wanted more or less the same things. And so, you know, that's kind of what Jerry was talking about in his story. My compatibility with Brad, I think, came more from, knowing each other over a decade and knowing each other's families. I was pretty confident it was going to work.
And Albert, how did you decide to partner up with him?
The funny thing is that Brad and Albert had been working together. When Brad and I decided to raise Union Square Ventures, start Union Square Ventures, Brad had already been working with Albert on a couple of projects, including Dakota, where Albert was recruited in to be a sort of crisis interim CTO early on in the beginning of that company. And we actually talked briefly about the idea of recruiting Albert to start Union Square with us. And I felt that it was more important to just have two partners in the beginning, to make sure that we got our partnership right, and that once we got that worked out, we could start adding third partners. But I thought starting right away with three was kind of a risky idea. And so instead, we worked with Albert on a couple of projects. He was the president of Delicious. He found Etsy and was the first board member for us on Etsy, and then founded a couple of other companies with us, and that led to us asking him to join the firm in a permanent capacity when we raised our second fund.
I see. What's the responsibility breakdown between the three of you?
We all do the same job. So, you know, the whole architecture of our business is, it's a very small business. There's a total of six people in the business. And that includes our administrative people. And, we are all generalists in the sense that nobody specializes. We're not generalists in terms of what we invest in, because we have a very specific investment thesis and a certain style of company that we invest in. But we're generalists in the sense that we all do sourcing, we all do managing our portfolio companies, we take turns handling the relationship with our investors and the administrative stuff. So everybody does everything in our firm.
Okay. 2003 is when you launched the business. What was the first
Correct.
Thing that you did? Am I right about that?
Yes, yes. Okay. So the first thing we did was we wrote, I would call it probably a 15 or 20 page white paper on the information technology venture business and what was right with it and what was wrong with it and where we thought it was headed. And we did that largely to build an investment thesis that we're actually still executing today. We developed probably four or five core principles in terms of what we would look for in an investment and what we believed the future of information technology was going to be. And and then once we completed that, we started talking to people about that, and then we quickly realized that even though we thought it was a spot on analysis, we realized it was going to be hard to sell that to financial investors, because it required, to understand what was going on in information technology at that time, required an understanding of the business and technology that, frankly, these large financial investors didn't have and we couldn't expect them to have. So we had to dumb down that story significantly and put something together that was much more simplistic in order to raise the fund.
Okay, I want to dig into some of what you said so far. The first is, what did you think the future would be when you were writing that white paper?
We thought that software was moving to the web, and that we thought that we saw the emergence of the cloud coming. We thought that the model of technology flowing from government/defense to business to consumer was flipping and that it was going to flow from consumer to business to government. We thought that the scale and the size of these web services was going to be global and measured in the billions, and that there was enormous opportunity for large networks that had data assets to scale into, you know, sizable businesses. And we had some examples already even then with Google, I think being a real guiding light in some ways for us back in 2003. But anyway, that was, we thought that the value was all in the application layer and not so much in the core infrastructure layer. So those are some of the kind of highlights of the analysis that we did back then.
Mm-hmm. I actually tweeted out a link to an old article from 2003 when you launched the business about about what your beliefs were about the future of the space, and so much of it was dead on, including, here's a quote that I've got, it's about one or two people building something, getting it into users' hands, and iterating. So much of what you believe the future would be happened, what were you wrong about?
Well, I don't know if wrong is the right word. What we should have figured out, but really didn't when we raised our first fund, was that the initial capital requirements for these businesses were going to be an order of magnitude lower than what they had been. So we essentially articulated that, the reasons for that, but we didn't take that into our financial models. So we went out and raised a $100 million fund, and we said that we thought we would make 10 or 12 investments, with the average initial investment being $2 to $3 million. And in fact, that didn't turn out to be the case. We ended up making 21 investments in that first fund. The average initial investment was about $1 million, and many were much smaller than that. The initial investment in Delicious was $400,000. The original investment in Etsy was $250,000. Some of our best investments, not all of them, but some of our best investments, we started with investments of less than $500,000. So we should have seen that coming, and we certainly have adapted our business to that reality. So it hasn't hurt us in any way, but it really was a miss in that way.
You said that once you came up with these ideas and wrote them down, you started talking to people about them. Who'd you talk to about them?
Well, mostly financial investors, the people we needed to fund the business. We also talked to colleagues in the venture business and entrepreneurs just to get sanity checks. And even among the industry insiders, VCs and entrepreneurs, we definitely got some blank stares. People didn't necessarily agree with what we thought made sense. And a number of people accused us of still buying into that internet thing. You have to remember 2003, memories were still short, and a lot of people had lost a lot of money in 2000, 2001. And there were certainly a number of people who thought what we were doing did not make sense. But fortunately, there were enough people we talked to who thought it did make sense that we went forward with it.
Do you have an example of somebody who helped shape your thought, helped change the way that you were thinking about the future of this space when you had those conversations?
Well, two people I give a lot of credit to are Yochai Benkler and Carlotta Perez, both of whom are academics who wrote pretty seminal academic papers that we were reading at the time. Carlotta wrote a very interesting piece about technology revolutions over time, going back to the Industrial Revolution, and how technology diffuses into society over time. And Yochai Benkler, of course, probably most famously known for The Wealth of Nations, a book he wrote a couple of years ago, The Wealth of Networks, a book he wrote a couple of years ago, at the time had written a very interesting piece called Coase's Penguin, talking about Coase's paper, The Firm, that he wrote a long time ago, and how that was becoming increasingly true. And so those were two pretty seminal pieces of academic research that influenced our thinking. And I'd have to give them both credit for that.
And how much did you say that you were trying to raise at the time?
$100 million.
Why start with $100 million and not do what you're seeing in the space? Why not start with a smaller amount and just launch something and iterate?
By 2003, I had been in the business 17 years, and hey Brad, I'm doing an interview on your Skype. My partner Brad just walked in. They're actually asking some really interesting questions. I just got to talk about Yochai Benkler
Go for it.
and Carlotta Perez. I felt. We both felt the question was about fund size. We both felt that we needed to have a significant fund that would allow us to go deep on our very best companies. And that's a lesson that you learn again and again in the venture capital business. And I'm glad we did it. We have almost $10 million in Twitter, for example, and we've got something like $7 or $8 million into Etsy now. And these are over 3 or 4 or 5 rounds of financing. So if you have a smaller fund size, you can't do that. And my friend Howard Lindzen said something interesting on his blog 2 days ago or yesterday. He wrote that entrepreneuring is a lot like being a running back, that every once in a while you break through the line and all of a sudden you find yourself in the open field. And when you do, you have to take advantage of that. And that's very true in the venture business. If you think about a portfolio of companies, maybe 20 companies, only half a dozen or so of those companies are going to break through the line and get into the open field. And the ones that do are the ones that are going to provide all of the most of the value, maybe all the value in a fund. And we want to be there for those companies with our capital because they're going to need it. And that's also where we want to invest our capital because those are going to be producing the highest gross returns of anything in the portfolio. So I don't really believe in the micro fund model. I think it works to a degree, and I definitely think you can make very good returns with the micro fund model. But I think what services the entrepreneur best is a fund size that sits between the micro fund and the mega fund, and I think $100 million is really a great fund size because it can do both.
All right, something else that you said earlier was that you dumbed down your message. How did you dumb it down?
We hired two women, Dana Gant and Jane Morris, who had at the time an advisory firm called Veritage Group up in Boston, and their specialty was helping funds raise first-time funds, which this was not for us as individuals, but for us together as a firm. And they understand the large investor community very well, and we worked with them. It was a frustrating process, not because of them, but because it's always frustrating to dumb something down. They were very helpful in making it simple. They had a requirement that we had to be able to do our pitch in 6 slides. And I love that because when someone forces you to do something in 6 slides, you really have to be crisp. And I learned a lot from that. I encourage a lot of entrepreneurs to try to do the same thing. When we sit in a presentation and an entrepreneur takes us through 40 slides, it's mind-numbing. And the entrepreneurs believe that they've got all this information and they got to get it out. But in reality, they'll have plenty of time to get all that information out. What they need to do in that first meeting is just convince you're someone that you want to spend more time with. And that's what Jane and Dana told us, and it was right.
So when you say dumb down, you mean simplify it, or did you take down?
Well, I mean both. Simplify it, but also, if you read either Carlotta Perez or Yochai Benkler, you'll go to sleep. It's complex and detailed and dry. And I imagine our thesis was some of that too. And so we just we made it simpler to understand and took away a lot of the more, I think, rigorous analytical stuff, which I think was important for us to do, but maybe not important for us to share.
I see. My friend Rosalind Resnick invested in the fund, I think, in the first one. Do
yes,
you know
she
Rosalind?
Did, absolutely.
She
I
said
do.
That, I'm sorry?
I do.
Okay, she said that when you approached her, you said that you, I think, I could be wrong here, but this is what I'm remembering. That you said that you made a mistake by not investing in her business, which was a bootstrapped email marketing business, and that you wanted her on not just as an investor, but as an advisor who will help you pick up on those opportunities that you might have missed in the first round of the internet. Has having her there and having that kind of thinking influenced the way you make decisions today?
We cultivated a group of about 20 or 30 entrepreneurs who were really successful in the first wave of the internet, and they all invested in that 2004 fund. And yes, it's been very helpful to have not just Rosalind, but lots of those kinds of entrepreneurs as investors in the fund.
Rosalind's belief, I think, at the time was that there were too many companies that weren't making money in the first round of the internet. When the bubble burst, people started to question that. Did you question the need for profits first and then late and the profits maybe? Did you question your belief about profits?
I think every business has to have profitability as its objective. Profitability is sustainability. If you're not profitable, you will go out of business at some point unless you can continue to finance the business, and financial markets aren't always going to be there. So profitability is important, but I don't think that optimizing for profitability early on in a company's life is generally the right thing to do if you're working on a large-scale opportunity. If you're working on a niche opportunity, it may well be. But it wasn't the right thing for Facebook to do. It wasn't the right thing for Google to do. It wasn't the right thing for Twitter to do. So there are situations where optimizing for profitability isn't the right thing to do.
Okay. So we talked about how you came up with the thesis behind the business, how you went out and talked to investors. How'd you find the first investments?
Our first investments?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Takoda was already there. Brad and I had been working on it, and it moved past the angel phase and into the VC phase around the time that we raised the fund. So Takoda was one of our first investments, and that was great because we, were able to put money into a company that we deeply understood and were already involved as strategic advisors, where we loved the management team. And that also turned out to be our first big exit. So that was great in many ways.
And then was the second company Delicious?
Delicious was probably the third or fourth company. Mm-hmm. Delicious was the first exit we had. It wasn't particularly important financial outcome for us, but Delicious was very important for us. I think it established our firm as a firm that would take chances and that understood some of these new emerging web services. And when we invest in Delicious, it was one person, Joshua, and I think that also showed that we were willing to get involved in things where there wasn't yet a team in place, all of which I think has gone on to serve us well reputationally.
Our mutual friend Mark Suster recently got into the venture capital business, and I remember when he first started in Los Angeles, he went out and he met everybody. Anyone with any entrepreneurial aspiration who didn't shake Mark Suster's hand and whose family names Mark Suster didn't know, he got that intimately involved in everyone. You already had some experience in the space, but you needed to meet more did you need to meet more entrepreneurs? How did you go about finding the companies that you'd end up investing in?
Well, you always need to meet more entrepreneurs. The minute you decide that you don't want to meet with entrepreneurs is the day you should get out of this business, because entrepreneurs are the raw material of the business. Without them, there's nothing. So that's a requirement every single day. The thing that I did differently with Union Square Ventures that I'd never done before was blog. And I started blogging right around the same time that we started Union Square Ventures in the late summer, early fall of 2003. And blogging has made it vastly easier for me to build relationships with entrepreneurs, even if they're just tenuous relationships in the beginning. They can turn into something much more, and so that has been a real boon, I think, to our business, and we've embraced it in many ways.
Do you have an example of something or of an investment that came from the blog?
Well, you know, I guess it depends on what you mean by it came from the blog, but Twitter, I would argue, came from the blog because as I was blogging, I was encouraging everybody else to blog, and it occurred to me that very few of the people that I thought should blog actually could wrap their heads around how to create long-form content every day. And when I started using Twitter, I immediately understood that Twittering was a lot like blogging, but with most of the same benefits, but without the same cost. And so we quickly were able to wrap our heads around why that was going to be a very large opportunity and make an investment there. And I think if you weren't a blogger, it would have been harder to figure that out.
I've got someone here in the live audience. Michael Yurechko says, Fred's blog got me my last job. Apparently he left a comment on your blog and you ended up connecting him with a local venture capitalist.
Yeah, Boris. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I wrote a blog post about the fact that many entrepreneurs don't go to college, and the comment thread turned into this raging debate about, you know, whether I was being irresponsible in encouraging people not to go to college, or whether, you know, it was okay to, you know, kind of speak that blasphemy. And Michael just left a comment saying, you know, I'm graduated from high school and I'm not going to college. And I responded, well, where do you live? And he said, Vancouver. And I said, send me an email. He sent me an email. I introduced him to my friend Boris, and he got a job. So there you go.
Boris, whose interview I did here just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
How else did you meet the companies that you invested in?
We try to be out in the marketplace as much as possible, going to tech meetups and hackathons and those kinds of things, and we try to be open to entrepreneurs as much as we can be, and so that's a big part of how we meet entrepreneurs.
Do you have an example of an entrepreneur who met you there who you ended up backing?
Well, I met Dennis Crowley, the founder of Foursquare, at ITP probably 5 or 6 years ago. ITP every year does this senior demo day thing where that's not what they call it, but where all the senior show their projects, and met Dennis. He was doing dodgeball at the time, and followed him through that experience, watched him sell it to Google, and then watched him leave Google, start Foursquare. So that, you know, that's a great example of somebody who I met 4 or 5 years ago who we didn't end up funding until less than a year ago. And you have to cultivate those relationships over time.
How did you cultivate, well, lost the pencil there. How did you cultivate that relationship over time?
Not very well, honestly. I mean, it wasn't like we really worked too hard on becoming, you know, Dennis's favorite VC or anything, which probably should have in hindsight, even though we are investors. You know, looking back on that, I'm a little embarrassed that we didn't spend more time with Dennis, because he really is a special entrepreneur. But you know, we're a little lucky here in New York that there's only a dozen or so venture firms that focus on the kinds of things that we focus on. So it's not quite like Silicon Valley, where there's 100 firms competing for an entrepreneur's attention. So we could get away with it. I think in the future we may not get away with it, but because I think that the New York market's getting a lot more competitive. But in that one, we were able to.
Did I just lose your connection?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay, sorry. Looked like we did. You said that he was a special entrepreneur. What makes for a special entrepreneur?
It's a combination of product vision and the ability to work with engineers to turn that into a functioning live experience on the web, and also the ability to rally people to your project or business to get those special engineers working with you, and also the ability to evangelize the idea in the media and in the marketplace. And that's a rare set of talents. Of course, if you think of the people who started many of the biggest and best web companies, they'll have most of those characteristics in common. But if you just look across the spectrum of people you meet every day, you'll quickly realize there aren't that many people who have that particular set of skills.
How does Dennis Crowley evangelize?
Well, you know, first of all, he does it in his online presence. He also does it in his physical presence. He's constantly evangelizing that vision, not in a, you know, kind of dogmatic sort of way, but, you know, just in terms of the way he lives his life and the things that he's interested in. And when you have a conversation with him, it always leads back to Foursquare, but not in kind of a pitch sort of way, just to kind of, you know, you realize this is somebody who's deeply passionate about what he does and has figured out how to be kind of the iconic power user of the service, and it's infectious.
I see. You mentioned Howard Lindzen earlier. He said that you gave him an opportunity to invest in Twitter, and he didn't take that opportunity, and he felt bad about it. But what I'm wondering is why? Why did you give him an opportunity to invest in Twitter with you?
No, I like Howard. I think he's a very talented entrepreneur and investor, and I knew he would understand Twitter, and he did understand Twitter, and he built a whole company on top of Twitter. That happened after we invested. Howard, you know, he just didn't understand why it was worth what I was willing to pay for it at the time, which is why he didn't do it. And that's fine. But it wasn't like he didn't understand it.
Well, what would having him as an investor do for the business?
He's a one-man promo. I mean, you know, Howard's out there promoting stuff he cares about, and he did it without even investing in Twitter. He's been promoting Twitter and stock twits and the idea of social media and so on and so forth. So he would have been great. He has been great, mm-hmm. You know, but it would have been great for him to have been an investor.
Right. I know as an entrepreneur, we get pains in our stomachs thinking about whether we'll make enough money, whether we made the right decision, whether we've made Fred Wilson happy in the 5 seconds that we got to meet him at a meetup. What I'm wondering is, do you have pains in your stomach, or is life just easy once you're on your side of the deal?
I think it depends on who you are.
How about you personally?
Yeah, I have pains in my stomach all the time. And the more successful our investments get, the more pains I have in my stomach about them. It's just how I'm wired up. I'm a worrier.
So how does that manifest itself? How does it express itself? Do you wake up in the middle of the night worried?
I woke up this morning at 3:45 in the morning.
What was on your mind, without getting into specifics?
Everything. I mean, you know, I'm a worrier. I'm a nervous Nelly. You know, it's I get wrapped around the axle about stuff.
So that it's not so close, and you wouldn't be revealing your feelings.
Doing that to the entrepreneurs who we invest in, I think if you talk to Evan Williams or contact Rob Kalin or any of the entrepreneurs that we work with, I think that they will probably tell you that they don't feel like I'm dumping my anxieties about their business on their lap. And that's my private set of anxieties, and I got to figure out how myself without making their life miserable. And I think I do a pretty good job about it. But nevertheless, most of the people I know in the venture business worry about their investments all the time.
Worry that what will happen?
Well, anything, right? They'll go out of business, they won't succeed, they'll be successful for a while, and then they'll stop being successful. That, you know, that $1 billion to get your management teams will fall apart, the talented people will leave. I mean, I go on and on. I mean, you know, I can recite you every nightmare I've ever had.
Do you think it ever goes away, or as you say, you think it's just part of who you are and it just will
For
always
me,
be there?
When I stop worrying, I think I should get out of the business.
At this point, it looks like we lost the connection. I'll reconnect and we'll pick up the program again. What do you think of what Jason Fried has been saying about how you're better off not taking money, starting slow, small, building up over time, and building a profitable business?
I think he's right if you can do that. And it depends on what kind of business you have. I think for a lot of these software as a service businesses, small enterprise-ish kind of businesses, I think that's a very good model. For the kinds of businesses that he's building, I think it's an excellent model. I don't necessarily think it's the right model for every business. So, you know, you gotta finance the business and develop a business plan that makes sense for the kind of business you're creating.
I see. What kind of exits do you look for from the businesses you invest in?
I think most of our businesses are likely to end up getting bought by a company that wants to own the technology or the team or both, or the business or the revenues and the profits. But I think we will see a return to public offerings, and I also think that we're going to have some exits to financial buyers who want to be in the internet sector. Who are either late-stage venture firms or growth equity firms or private equity firms. For example, you know, Skype was bought by a consortium of VCs and private equity firms for, I think, $3.5 billion. There's no reason why, you know, Twitter couldn't be bought. This is just an entirely theoretical example. I'm not telegraphing anything here at all. Just, there's no reason why Twitter couldn't have a change in ownership the way that Skype had a change of ownership, and wouldn't necessarily have to flow through an eBay type of acquisition along the way. That's all I'm trying to say. So I think that there are some other forms of exits for the early stage investors and founders that don't necessarily require a sale to a strategic buyer or a public offering.
What about you? What kind of exit are you looking for from Union Square Ventures?
Not looking for an exit from Union Square Ventures.
Why is venture capital so different from the companies that it invests in? I mean, you look for growth industries, and as you've said on your blog, venture capital isn't a growth industry. You look for companies that can have an exit, and in your own business, you don't look for an exit. Why are there so many differences?
Well, venture capital is a service industry for entrepreneurs. We're like lawyers and accountants and PR firms and that ilk. We're a service business. We provide a service to entrepreneurs. The service we provide is capital, and if we do our job well, some advice and counsel and good fiduciary board representation. But we're a service business, and I think that venture firms are a lot more like law firms or accounting firms than they are, tech startups.
Let's take a few questions from the audience here since we're getting in at the end of the interview. Todd W. wants to know, what lessons can a single founder learn from Delicious, the company that was founded by a single founder?
Well, eventually you're going to have to choose. You can't, as the business scales, you can't do it all yourself forever. And, you know, Joshua chose to raise some money and build a team and scale the business. And then he went and sold the company. He could have sold the company for probably $3 to $5 million before he raised capital. He had offers. He raised some capital, not very much, about $1 million, I think, and sold the company for $30 million. So obviously there was a order of magnitude improvement in the value he got out by raising a little money, building a team, and going for another year to 18 months. So that's the lesson of Delicious, is that you can't go it alone forever, and you're going to face a hard choice at some point, and you have to figure out what the right answer is.
A few people in the chat room are asking, how can an entrepreneur get to meet you? What's the best way to meet you?
I think getting an introduction is probably the best way to meet me. Another good way is to engage with me in social media. And that might take a little bit of effort. I generally start to recognize people's names the second or third time they leave a comment on my blog or send me a Twitter or something. And sometimes it'll take four or five times before I really actually check out who they are and start to get a sense of what they're doing. But those are lightweight interactions. They don't cost very much. And they're, I think, pretty effective at getting my attention over time. So that's another good way.
All right, one more question from the audience before I ask my two wrap-up questions, and that is, Jeff is asking, how important is location, do you think, for an entrepreneur?
Where you are you in like San Francisco or New York or Boston or Austin? I think it's important to be somewhere where there's some critical mass of tech companies and tech investors. And the reason for that is it's hard to recruit talent into a region where there isn't some of that. So I think it's okay to be in Boston, New York, Seattle, Los Angeles, Austin, Boulder, probably Chicago, you know, and a few other cities. Then you start getting into, you know, kind of tenuous territory where I think it's much harder. It's not impossible, it's harder to build a company.
Okay, here are my two last questions. What can I do a better job here with the interviews that I do?
I don't know. I think you do a pretty good job. The questions are good. They're varied. You asked me a few questions today no one's ever asked me before. So you seem prepared. You seem to have done your homework. I'm impressed, frankly.
All right. I got to meet you through an introduction. Who that you know, which entrepreneur that you know should I be interviewing to learn about how to build a business? Who's got a story I should be talking to, I should be hearing here?
You know who are really good entrepreneurs that nobody really talks very much about are the two founders of Indeed.com, job search company, which is actually quite a significant company now. They're serial entrepreneurs located in New York and Connecticut and Austin, Texas. Paul Forster and Ronnie Kahan, great entrepreneurs, built an amazing company, strong technologists, you know, really good business people, and I don't think that many people know about them. So they are one of the secrets of Union Square Ventures.
If I send you an email, can you make an introduction or forward my email to them?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Well, Fred, thank you for spending this time with me. I appreciate you doing the interview.
Thank you.
All right.
Take
care.
Thank
you all for watching.
Bye.
Bye.